Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guests this week are Kirsten Dirksen and Nicholas Boyosa. Since 2007, Kirsten and Nicholas have been producing Fair Companies, a web series that's evolved to become one of the most comprehensive archives of compact homes and simple living, including lean urbanism, self-sufficiency, smart gardens, craftsmanship, and philosophies of life. Hi, Kirsten and Nicholas. How are you?
Good.
Hi, great. Thank you.
Yeah, really welcome to our little podcast about cool tools. We can't wait to hear what you have in mind.
Okay. Do you want us to start?
Yeah. Let's start. And why don't you tell us about nonlinear editing?
Okay. Well, I chose that because that completely revolutionized my working life. When I started in television, there was no, I guess to what would make sense to people is to think of iMovie, which is what comes, you know, now loaded on an Apple device. But there's also a device, you can get the same program for, or you can get nonlinear editing program for an Android or for any other device. Really simple and usually free. And when I started, you know, you would have to actually make cuts. So you were laying video from one tape to another. And so you'd go down the line, you'd had to be completely prepared before you went in for an edit. And there was sort of no spontaneity in the editing process. And if you did want to make a spontaneous edit, you'd lose a generation. So then when nonlinear editing came around, which was very expensive when it first came out, it wasn't something you could have at home. But at work, that really changed the whole process. And you could start playing a little bit and, oh, let's try this, or maybe try it with music, or try it without music, or try, you know, we could try things and, well, we'll maybe move the beginning to the end. And so eventually, when the pricing came down, then I could start sort of doing things on my own, which is sort of what I started to do, first working for networks in New York. And then when I moved to Europe and I met Nico, we started doing stuff and you could just do it out of your house. And YouTube sort of was barely starting and we started putting videos up there. That was Nico's idea. And, you know, for several years, nobody really saw them, but it was a lot of fun. We were experimenting.
It was.
Yeah,
it made sense. And so the example you would say of the tool is iMovie, which is packaged with most Apples. It's kind of the default thing, but there's, you know, the Adobe has Premiere and there's Apple Final Cut Pro, which are basically the same things, but kind of on steroids, right?
Exactly. And when we first at the network I was working at, it was Avid that first came out. And there was, you know, there's just lots of different products out there. And I think Final Cut, when I first bought it, I paid $1,000. So, you know, when it was a big deal, people were sort of,
Back in the day, I remember first time you were coming back and forth from New York to Barcelona. And I do remember hard drives were huge, but it's not that they were huge, but they just didn't, they weren't able to carry a lot of stuff.
Yeah, so each hard drive was probably the size of a shoebox and was 30 gigs.
Sure, right. Exactly. Well, these days you're still producing videos at a prolific clip. What are you using? Are you using Final Pro or are you a Premiere?
I still use Final Cut. Yeah, because I was working at a couple networks that were using that in New York and I got used to it. I learned Avid when I first started. I was working at a network called Oxygen. It was a women's network in 2000. And the way I learned was just to use, because the edit machines, all that was so expensive. I think it was $250,000 each machine is what they paid. And so I would stay from about 10 o'clock at night till 6 in the morning and edit and then go home for a couple hours and sleep and come back to work.
It's like using mainframes in the beginning, computers in the beginning of computers.
So are you doing your editing on your kind of work editing, we'll call it? Are you doing it on a laptop? Or are you doing it on a desktop?
I was on a desktop probably, not for about, 7-8 years that had some towers. But now just with the traveling and everything, it was kind of hard to go back and forth. And so now, a laptop, it seems to, it's fine. You know, it's a lot sometimes.
With the butterfly keyboard, works fine.
Yeah. No. And I think for me, the real difference is less the technology, when you don't have to think about the technology. But for me, the difference between sort of linear editing and nonlinear editing is actually before, you know, I would go into an edit and I had to have everything really scripted. The video, all my video calls were on the left, and on the right was the voiceover. And I would sit with an editor and say, okay, here it is at this second, come in at this second on that tape, and take, like, it was down to that precision. And you had to have sort of that in your head, but it's a video. So putting it on paper, I think you really lose something. So when I started doing nonlinear editing, I see it more as kind of sculpting the material. So now I actually do it backward, what everyone else does, but I dump all the material on a timeline. And then it's supposed to be in and out, use I and the O as sort of the keys, but actually I'm cutting those out. So it's really, I'm going out and in with those, you know, as I'm cutting out of the timeline, I'm just cutting down. So I have, you know, maybe 2 hours of material to begin with, and I cut it down to 40 minutes, and then I cut it down and cut it down.
So yeah, so you're saying instead of like taking a blank timeline and adding what you need, you're saying I'll put everything that I recorded in and I'll just cut away stuff I don't want.
Exactly.
That's a secret sauce of artists that do everything. It's like orchestra people who are able to do the whole process. It's going back to the old days and making the whole trade yourself. But be producing your own paper in order to write your own book and distribute it and everything. It's like fanzines from back in the day.
And just since we're on the topic of video, and I know that there's also been a revolution in the cameras. You're talking about, you know, hard disk being shoeboxes. Well, you know, the early cameras, video cameras, were huge, cumbersome. Most people these days seem to be almost filming on like a Panasonic, you know, a 35 millimeter, what equivalent of a 35 millimeter camera that's really small. Have you gone in that direction as well?
It actually has gotten really small, but I have to say, it makes me think of the first camera we had when I was a kid. My father's an engineer in Silicon Valley and kind of an early adapter with a lot of the products. So he came home one day with a video camera in the early 80s. And it was, I don't know if you remember that. I don't know if you had something like this or if most people did, but I didn't see a lot of them. It was a whole VCR that you'd put on your shoulder. And then you had a huge camera that was the size of, you know, what people would see from television stations. And so you'd be filming with your VCR on your shoulder. And we would do that. So we have a lot of footage when I was a kid. And that's when I started playing, because there was always something. And then, you know, we moved on to Hi-8 tapes and all the other stuff, the different variations and versions.
So what are you using today?
So today, I mean, I use a DSLR camera. It's small, and you know, there's a lot of good ones out there. I don't think that there's one necessarily better than the other, but I just switched fairly recently. For a long time, I was just sticking with, I had been using, you know, larger cameras for a long time and regular video cameras for a long time. And I was actually really hesitant to use a gimbal because I don't want things to look too clean. And that's a lot of Nico actually too. We're both talk a lot about that, is just, you know, we're not filming commercials and you want things to feel real. So where do you find that spot in the, you know, the sweet spot, really?
People sometimes forget that when you're watching a movie, when everything gets very smooth and intimate, people just forget the camera is slightly moving because somebody's holding it. They just don't understand it comes naturally because it's a style. And sometimes when I watch stuff from Kirsten, I have the same feeling. It's easy to forget there's a style behind, like John Ford was able to do. You just forget there's a director. It comes naturally. That's very difficult to do. And I think technology, it's just a tool. We are talking about cool tools. It's a tool, but the most powerful tools are people directing them, in the sense that if you don't know how to use it, use them in with the right on the right quantity in the right amount, it can literally not only improve your product, but it could go the opposite way.
So maybe moving off of the camera tools that you guys use professionally so much, you also have some suggestions about cool furniture that you use and like.
Well, we've done a lot of videos on robotic furniture. I guess it started with transforming furniture. We've done a lot of apartments where people transform their apartments, the Murphy bed, things that twist and turn, and, you know, bookcases that become beds, or, you know, people like joke in the comments, like, when's a toilet going to become a bed? Because literally everything becomes a bed in some videos. But we've done several videos now with people who have created robotic furniture. So the first one we did was, I think it was Hacier Larrea.
He's Spanish MIT, as well. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he started with the MIT.
From the Media Lab.
Yeah. The Media Lab. And then from there, he took some of that stuff and started some of the, I guess,
he
technology.
Was collaborating, with some industrial designers.
And so basically the idea is that one of the things would be like a wall that moves so you can change room sizes, but it's just a push of a button. And now it's probably voice commanded. I think at the time it was a really just early prototype, but you know, most of the stuff becomes that. And the bed also comes out separately on another command. And then the most recent one was Bumblebee Spaces in San Francisco that's doing that. And they're actually incorporating it I think they're in New York and San Francisco, maybe LA as well. And they're doing it a lot with the co-living spaces. So they're working together to sort of, because in co-living spaces, you have one bedroom. So to make that one bedroom work further, the bed drops from the ceiling, the bookcases and all that stuff drop from the ceiling. And the thing that they've added to it is to make the furniture kind of smart, I guess, or smart's kind of an overused term, but that you can, he called it Marie Kondo in the ceiling, because everything is cataloged with a camera, right?
It basically can learn from patterns it studies, so it becomes better as it goes. It's the old promise that can actually be something that materializes. There is also a sweet spot there that can go easily wrong as well. So therefore,
it tells you what you're using and what you're not using. So it's catalyzed everything. So they say, well, you haven't used your, you know, this bathing suit in a while. Why don't you get rid of it? Or why don't you play some tennis? Your tennis racket sitting there.
Basically, the idea is to sort of looking for the equilibrium, as we learn, between privacy and what we actually want to be told, or what do we want to know from external sources, because sometimes it can feel in the beginning a little bit awkward that somebody's telling.
So if a listener wanted one of these, what would they, where would they get it?
This was Bumblebee Spaces. We did but they have a fee for a monthly fee for upkeep, and they install. And so I'm not sure how high the prices are. I'm not sure they're even looking at a consumer market. It looks more like
we were actually, you remember, Kirsten, we were actually looking at the early stages. They were preparing for.
He said in August they'll have something that's a lot slipper.
For commercialization, yeah.
And was there any of these that you love so much that you've actually put into your own home?
We haven't.
How about if we could choose, right? I would like to experiment with any of those, and also with mechanical versions of them, from good Murphy bed all the way to what companies like Italian company Clay does, which is a company with Visit as well. We've talked to the founders, and they do basically a previous iteration of it, which is getting almost the same service with a mechanical structure.
And they have some.
We're talking about a process that didn't start yesterday. It's a process that comes from mechanical parts and furniture that started actually before Enlightenment. And then it accelerated with, let's say, industrialization and the process of mass production. And now we are hopefully in another stage.
Because it started, so Clay is a perfect example, because they started in the 60s, I think, with transforming furniture. So they took beyond sort of the bunk bed that moved. They did a bunk bed that moved, but they also did the couch that came out of the wall and flipped down and things that spun. Yeah.
So if I'm not really clear, but I thought you were saying that you have these bunk beds in your home.
We don't actually have those bunk beds. I'm saying we just have regular bunk beds. We are way back.
We do have. Are you guys interested? Are you interested in knowing what sort of furniture we do have? We have.
But very as far basic as do we have any transformers?
Furniture, but what we can tell about a very interesting iteration we did or discovery we did. We needed a big bed, a big table, and very cheap, but also very that was multifaceted. We ended up doing a huge research. We were willing to pay a lot of money. We ended up with actually ping pong table. The cheapest one was one that didn't have wheels, but was one that could just partition. It did have a partition right in the middle. That table is actually we just
ping pong table.
Yeah. I mean, it looks kind of.
A ping pong table became our working, eating, homework.
It actually says on the bottom, do not use as furniture because it's so cheap. It's the cheapest sort of modernist looking furniture you can buy.
It's a 150 euro ping pong table, and it is foldable. People jump on top on parties. No, I see.
And it's relatively lightweight too, right?
Yeah, it is, and it really does. I think the style.
And when we were actually, I mentioned it to an architect in Barcelona, and he emailed me back right away, and he was saying, "Actually, you tell me how it goes." He was sort of dubious, but then he came, and actually, aesthetically, was appealing as well. So there we go. So there is an adaptation of something that was designed for another type of use that did work in another perspective, and it did pay off fairly well for the price.
And is there was this a particular brand? You recall what the brand of this particular ping pong table that you really liked?
Well, it'd be the equivalent of going to, let's say, the REI co-op from Washington, up in Washington State, and purchasing the cheapest, good looking, big size.
Even probably cheaper than that. It was a really cheap sports store. A chain store.
It is a cheap store, but, yeah, the perspective of it is, do you
affordable,
agree with me?
It's
like a co-op
affordable,
similar to. Yeah.
Right.
REI, for example.
And so for you, some of the benefits of this table was that it was foldable. Do you ever fold it up?
We do. When we just have to prepare the space for, working parties, family reunions, homework from children.
Okay, that's a great suggestion. Is there any other furniture in your house that you want to rave about and think that people should know about? Because you guys, I would imagine, doing so many videos about small houses and that kind of living, that some of that must must rub off on you.
But a lot of it's just found stuff. I mean, we found like our working chairs on the street, you know, that kind of thing. All our chairs, and then we have just a bunch of chairs that were in the apartment when you arrived that are just folding, like folding wooden chairs that we use.
There is a small standing desk I use all the time. This small standing desk is not something you can tweak. It actually comes and it's very. You basically set it up to a working environment, and it does work like a pulpit in English. It's similar to a pulpit. I've seen pictures of different people across different ages working on similar environments. It does help me when I do need to change the context, and I do get this help from a change in actually physical perspective. Sometimes the stories are blocked, or I would like to think about other things, and then I just go to that small, and it does work. It's a fairly cheap piece of furniture anybody just can add to any sort of small bedroom. It's not going to take a lot of room, and the amount of service you take from it is just unbelievable.
And so is there another tool on your list that you would like to suggest?
Well, Kirsten was very kind. She got me into collaborating with this list, and then I just we were talking about what Wood could come with, and I did think that it was probably more interesting to sort of bring something that can actually be useful for a lot of people. I do think that we found visiting people and being in different places with different let's say environments we did need to, let's say, to fight the extreme heat. We did need to sleep well because we did have very demanding days in some hour, just some hours away. So in those situations, you sort of try to learn from what people around you are doing. So one of the things I find that helped us in different environments is knowing how to, for example, cool yourself when you don't have access to air conditioning. And we do think that evaporative air conditioning, which is basically using a clay container with cold water inside around you when it's really hot, this water is going to evaporate basically, and it's going to over time, it's going to actually help you. It's not going to be a rush of cold air in your face. We are not talking about it. We are talking about some sort of survival technique that can help you sleep a good night when it's extremely hot somewhere and you don't have.
So I'm not really following how. I mean, I know that there are throughout the tropics there's clay water pots that are cool the water through evaporation, and I don't know whether you could, where you could buy one today, but you were talking about cooling yourself. So is there a tool that you are using or a technique?
The tool would be, for example, if there's no tool at all, I'd get a bucket of water. It doesn't need to be clean water. And then let's say if I have a space that is, for example, an indoor patio somewhere, preferably with some plants on it, I'm going to take this water and carefully I'm going to spread this water on surfaces that are porous, have some porosity on it. This water is going to just go to these surfaces, is going to look for the minimum the places where it can go and fill the cracks. And then because it's really warm, heat is actually going to take all these water molecules, it's going to put them in the ambient. If a person is utilizing that environment in that precise moment, that environment is going to be cooler than anything surrounding it.
So we used to spray down our terrace, our patio, with water, and then when it was really hot, and kids would run on it, or we would be out there. But also, you know, we did a story with someone in West Texas. Who just uses the swamp cooler. John Wells, he just made his own swamp cooler, evaporative cooler. You know, that it's fairly simple, but it actually works. I mean, it's so hot out there, over 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
It was over 100 degrees one day.
And inside it was much, much, much cooler.
And he demonstrated actually inside of people call a tiny house these days. We sort of helped.
Sort of a tin house too. I'm not.
And we were probably five people there.
Yeah.
And there was this tiny thing using nothing of energy, almost nothing.
Does it work better in dry climates rather than humid climates?
Yeah, well, because you can't get rid of the humidity.
Mark is right. I should have explained it in a more orderly way. It's basically something that can work in dry climates on the shade.
Okay.
Yeah.
Singapore is not going to be so effective.
New York during heat waves.
But even for drinking, there's the botijo, which is a Spanish custom. You still can buy them in stores in Spain. I mean, they're a classic thing, but it's a clay pot that they used for keeping, instead of a thermos, they keep for keeping water cool.
I'd say going local as well in southern Spain back in the day in Al-Andalus when Granada was one of the important cities of Al-Andalus, it's still can be based. The interior patio of the lions. It works this exactly the same way. It's a technique, cultures across the Silk Roads, like the book, have used over centuries. So it's not inventing anything, but just using what that has worked, especially under extreme circumstances when there is no electricity.
So in the few minutes remaining, why don't you guys tell us about your channel or what the current project that you're working on or what you're excited by these days?
I mean, I think it's to keep exploring new ideas because you don't want to sort of keep telling the same story. So it's finding what that story is. And I mean, a lot of it is sort of the housing crisis you see worldwide. So that's something that, you know, it's not just about here's a pretty little tiny house or something, or how fun is this, but it's a reality for a lot of people. And that keeps changing, whether that means, you know, people who are trying to sort of CNC cut their houses or, you know, making things more, less reliant on really high costs of labor in certain parts like California.
And where can people go to get that from you?
Well, that was one of the latest stories. But there's several YouTube that are channel. Doing it. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the YouTube channel, one of the most recent ones was on, what was that cover, you know, or whatever. But there's several companies trying to do that. I'm not sure if they're there yet. Again, like that we keep telling the story. And
we basically, I remember we did a video back in the day, and we called that video Age of Pre-Hoverboards, because it was the first one of the first commercial skates with actually with traction, electrical traction, basically. And that was San Francisco. That was right before what happened afterwards with all the electric scooters in the city. So we're interested in these ages of pre-hoverboards all over, and we like to read things, and we take
that
references.
That also ties into, like, Nico's also written, we've done a trilogy. I guess we have a couple trilogies we've done. That's something we talked about. And we have a documentary
series. A trilogy. Is this something that's written like text on paper, like a book, or is this a trilogy of videos?
Two things. So there's a video trilogy, which is over the years. The first one was We the Tiny House People. And it's a little bit of our origin story. And then we have a couple more that were road trips.
The other is Van Life.
There's one on Summer Family Love was a
before
Van Life
van
thing.
Van Life again. So it's Van Life before Van Life.
And these are all video trilogies.
They're all videos. Yes. Yeah, they're all over an hour, long form.
The third one is about lean urbanism, which is basically what happens when there is no urbanism and you need to create something from scratch, like Burning Man.
Or the raw parts of the U.S. where there's no codes or zoning or that type of thing.
Exactly. Or like encampments of, let's say, refugees, crisis,
or
climate crisis.
In West Oakland, where we have a couple of friends who've been experimenting.
And what's that one called? What's that trilogy called?
So the trilogy is the name of – it doesn't have a name, though each
Fair
one
Company
has a name.
Trilogy.
Fair Company Studio.
Kirsten's Trilogy.
No, well, I mean, how would someone find
it? So you could look for We the Tiny House People. You could look for Summer of Family Love, or you could look for Spaghetti Western of Lean Urbanism. Those are the names of the three. And then Nico's written a fiction trilogy, and – you know, it's a sort of past, present, and future. And I think the future one is the one that ties in most to sort of tech, because
it's like an exercise about, I read a poem by T.S. Eliot on time, and that poem stayed for a while with me. And it's just a reflection on that poem and also on the concept of time. It involves physics, but also human perception. And it has some illusion. It has some science fiction. Some things I read. Some references that are very close, actually, to you both. And
inspired by our time in Menlo Park.
In the end, it's the whole thing. It's a conversation of probably us both trying to sort of create this personal philosophy of life that has to, quoting Tim O'Reilly, has to give more than it captures. And we are all in that. I mean, I don't know if you agree, Kirsten, but I do think I'm 42 now, and I love to think by myself. And
So I guess the future section is, you know, the whole concept of augmented reality and augmenting ourselves with these sort of assistance that everyone has implanted in their brains when they're born, and that kind of idea. And so it's dystopic.
And again, what is the name of that one?
Well, this could be called the Long Now trilogy. In the future, maybe if there is
the future is the valley of the phosphorescent.
talking about the future, but in the future, maybe there is a chance to translate it into English because it's actually Spanish. I do write in Spanish.
It's in Spanish.
Right, yeah. It is in Spanish.
I should have explained that I'm from Spain, but I also write in Spanish. I do write in English, so we'll see in the future. But in the end, it's all about, I guess. Well, you can. I think you should.
But I guess it ties into things we talk about all the time. So I think the channel, the website, books, all that is part of our bigger conversation on what technology means in our lives, where it's going, where it's coming from, how much of it do we want in our lives, how much is good for us, how much is helpful, how much maybe isn't. I mean, even furniture, you can relate to that way. You know, sometimes it's too much, you know,
For example, I would like to mention that chairs, for example, there was that example. Sometimes chairs, we forget that chairs are for sitting, and then a chair takes a lot of room. If you have a lot of chairs, but you are not using them for this service, which is sitting, then there is a problem there. So maybe, let's say,
Forced air chair?
Well, or maybe a field that is not physical that can give you that service, it's going to work better for you.
Yeah.
So what I mean is that you understand you need something that the chair gives you, but that doesn't mean you should have a chair all the time taking room.
So maybe your hoverboard becomes the chair.
For example, or a rock, like Zarathustra's rock, right? So a rock can be a chair if that is the service you're looking for.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. And so where's the best place for people to find all this goodness? What's the place for them to start? Is it your?
So there's the YouTube channel. Yeah. There's a YouTube channel.
I think from the YouTube channel,
that's
it goes to
YouTube Kirsten Dirksen. That would be a name. Yeah.
How do you spell it?
God, are you serious?
All right. So that's the best place for people to start then.
Yeah, that's the best place to start. And faircompanies.com. Okay. And that has all the other stuff listed. And it has our bios and things on there too.
Yeah. Can I add that it was great? I mean, to us, just to have, we were talking about how special is a place when somebody that doesn't need to just email personally to contact forms in obscure websites. It's not that person does it personally, but does it writing something from scratch. That's something that needs to be pointed out in an era of depersonalization of things. I do think that needs to be pointed out. That was Kevin Kelly just
thank you for the email instead of
writing to the contact form of faircompanies.com and just personally writing a message that wasn't written beforehand.
Okay, well, you're welcome. I'm glad you guys came on. It was such a delight to hear the backstory behind the many videos that I've watched. And we really appreciate you taking time to explain not just your selections of cool tools, but also your philosophy. So thank you for that very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Kirsten and Nicholas. This was really interesting.